Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia.
Garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
that's the wonderful Dara Williams singing with Pete Seeger and David Burns, who wrote the song. Oh, the words to the song, except for Solartopia, which I wrote. We're back for a great hour here in the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. We've got a magnificent guest, a true national treasure with us, Carl Grossman, speaking to us from
Thank you, Harvey.
Thank you, Carl, and speaking to us from a place where you helped prevent the operation of the Shoreham nuclear power plant, one of the great victories for humankind. And you've been in this fight for the Earth and for the environment and against the Atomic Reaper I won't say it. How many years?
Well, I began in journalism, would you believe, 60 years ago? I started off in journalism in your home state, Harvey, Ohio. There was an Antioch College internship I took at the Cleveland Press, which was a wonderful newspaper. It's so sad it's gone, a crusading newspaper. And pretty quickly, I was just a copy boy, but pretty quickly I became a reporter back in where I'm from. I'm from Long Island, New York. And the first big story I was involved in was a fight against a highway that Robert Moses, he was this public works czar in New York, loved roads, never drove, didn't know how to drive, didn't have a license, but he loved highways, so he was responsible for the Long Island Expressway, accurately described as the biggest parking lot in the world, Southern State Parkway, Northern State Parkway, on which, let me note, he built bridges only 11 feet high, so African Americans and Latinos from New York wouldn't head to Long Island and go to the various beaches he built, like Jones Beach. And again, so wrapped up in highways as opposed to a balanced mass transportation system, he wanted to build this four-lane highway, the length, 35-mile length, of a beautiful barrier beach called Fire Island. And as a my first job as a reporter, I challenged Moses, wrote story after story over a two-year period, and I pushed the alternative, which was to have Fire Island becoming a national seashore, which it became in 1964. And that combination of investigative reporting and environmental journalism became my specialty. And not many years later, I applied it to nuclear power. And it wasn't just Shoreham. 7 to 11 nuclear power plants were planned for Long Island. Long Island would become, in the parlance of the nuclear promoters of the time, a nuclear park. And I spent, not 2 years, over 20 years doing journalism, investigating and crusading, and I was a figure in stopping. Well, Shoreham was completed; it was ready to open, stopping that from happening, and stopping these other nuclear plants that the utility wanted to build. And also, I was a factor in closing down the two nuclear reactors. There's one of these national nuclear laboratories on Long Island, like there's Oak Ridge and Los Alamos and these various nuclear laboratories around the country, all of them Superfund sites, very dirty operations. And there was one, a Superfund site on Long Island, Brookhaven National Laboratory, and did a lot of journalism on the mess that it was causing radioactive-wise, and those two reactors at Brookhaven Lab were shut down. So, end of story, Long Island, New York, all 120 miles of it east of New York City is nuclear-free. No nuclear power plants, no nuclear reactors. It is now what all of the United States should be, nuclear-free. It is now what all the world should be, nuclear-free, as we transition to what Harvey Wasserman has campaigned for so many years, Solartopia.
Well, you've been really a force of nature here, Carl. I just read a major, a real beautiful piece about you. Where did this appear? Tell people where to go.
It appeared in the Independent newspaper, which circulates on Eastern Long Island, and people can read it online. Just online, just in Google, put in East End Independent, Carl Grossman, and it'll come right up. I'm just looking at it right now on my computer. East End Independent, Carl with a K, Grossman, and the article, which is a lovely article. It'll come immediately up, and actually, I'm looking here, Shine Light on Carl Grossman is the headline, and where that comes from, because I told the excellent writer who did the column, that when I worked at the Cleveland Press, I was so impressed with the motto of the press. It was above the entrance to the newspaper. And it's the motto today still of the Scripps Howard newspapers, give light and the people will find their own way. And so the piece by Dennis Hamill, who is the younger brother, incidentally, of Pete Hamill, if listeners don't know the name Dennis Hamill, they will probably know Pete Hamill, very wonderful New York-based journalist. And so they did the headline, Shine Light on Carl Grossman, and this lovely spread of my years, my decades now, in journalism. The road story is there, my fight against nuclear power plants and nuclear power, all there. It's a lovely piece. I'm thrilled, you know, after all these years to have an article kind of like, well, documenting years of work.
Yeah, it's a really great piece. I urge people to read it. It really is the story of a national hero. Carl,
oh, thank you, Harvey.
I've been lucky enough to actually ride on your sailboat on Long Island, and you know, knowing that the place is nuclear free, I'm assuming, of course, that if Shoreham had opened. Well, it opened for like 5 minutes, right? These jerks, didn't they fire it up
well,
for 5 minutes to get some kind of tax or whatever incentive?
Well, what these bums did, these utility bums did, the utility was called the Long Island Lighting Company. It was a utility, in fact, in a book I wrote called Power Crazy about Shoreham and these other nuclear plants Loco wanted to build. They weren't able to run coal plants, oil plants. They were on the brink of bankruptcy in the 30s and in the 40s. And here, this company, in an alliance with Brookhaven National Laboratory, wanted to build all these nuclear plants on Long Island. There's still vestiges. In fact, when we went sailing, Harvey, I don't know if I pointed it out to you, but at the site of what was to be four nuclear power plants in Jamesport, just east of Shoreham, along the Long Island Sound also, is a meteorological tower. The government requires utilities that want to build nuclear plants to put up a meteorological tower to get baseline readings of wind and other meteorological information. Big, tall thing, and it's still there. I mean, the site of where they were going to build four nuclear plants, Loco, and the government, the federal government, gave the go-ahead for the first two. that thankfully has become a state park. It's no longer a site for nukes. But that tower is still there, and you can see it from the water. You can see it just where we went sailing in Peconic Bay, that tower, that remnant of this effort to turn Long Island into a nuclear park.
Unbelievable. It's really unbelievable. Talking with Carl Grossman from Long Island, you are a full professor of journalism at what school? How long have you been teaching? How many students do you think you've had over the decades?
Thousands. I mean, thousands, because I've been teaching for, 42 years. I mean, I've been doing investigative reporting for, so many years, and teaching it for so many years. And every semester, I teach a course at the State University of New York College at Old Westbury, it's an amazing school. It's within the SUNY system, but actually, it, in many respects, it's like the college back in Ohio. I went to college, Antioch College. In many respects, it's like Antioch, which is a very innovative school. In fact, Antioch students were on the planning committee for the State University of New York College at Old Westbury. I've been teaching since 78 at SUNY Old Westbury, every semester teaching investigative reporting. It reputedly is the first investigative reporting class, began before I got there in 78. Deidre English, who now is on the faculty at the University of California School of Journalism in Berkeley, out on the West Coast, now your neck of the woods, she taught it, and then she went off to become the editor of Mother Jones. They suddenly had a vacancy. I had done investigative reporting at the Long Island Press, also wrote a column. And they knew my work, and so they asked me to go to Old Westbury and teach investigative reporting in Deidre English's stead. And I couple that with a course in environmental journalism, teach that every semester, too. I also run an internship program placing students throughout the New York metropolitan area on internships, which is how I got into journalism. At Antioch College, it was this internship at the Cleveland Press, which inspired me to go into journalism. So, in terms of numbers, I teach maybe 100 students a year, and you multiply that by 42, you get thousands of students that have been through my investigative reporting and my environmental journalism classes.
So who are your rock stars? Have you had any of your students that have unearthed, small stories like, say, Watergate or other stuff?
I didn't hear you too clearly, Harvey. Can you just repeat that?
Okay. Who are your rock star students that we might point to who've done such great things as you have over the years?
Well, there's some excellent journalism being done today in the United States. I'm thinking about the journalists who are now not normalizing the Trump administration. But, I mean, here you have, it's beyond scandalous, this preposterous president we have, Trump. And this gang of scoundrels surrounding him, from the so-called attorney general to agency after agency, and in the area that I'm particularly concerned about, the environment and energy, it's foxes guarding the hen houses all over. In fact, I did a book when Reagan first got in, because it was clear to me that he was bringing in folks from polluting industries to be in charge of environmental it was called the poison conspiracy. Indeed, in the book, and they use it on the book jacket, there's a listing on and on of, for example, Rita LaValle from Aerojet in California, one of the big polluters in California, and she was put in charge of the Superfund program, this effort to deal with pollution, and on and on and on. And these days, frankly, I tell this to my students, as bad as it was with Reagan, and it was bad. Now, you wouldn't believe the... in fact, the New York Times just a few weeks ago had a full page of various department heads under Trump and the environmental or energy agencies that they headed, or number two, number three, number four, number, and went right down, five, six. And one, I mean, as corrupt as the Reagan administration was, this Trump administration, the Democratic candidates, one or the another, are saying it's the most corrupt national administration in U.S. history, and there's been stiff competition, frankly. And journalists all over this country have solid, strong, effective, and highly capable investigative journalists have come up to the plate and have been challenging the outrages of the Trump administration. It's been very important because, I mean, he's been able to, so important because he's been able to neutralize congressional oversight. Just look what happened with the impeachment. I mean, this is a president who so deserves impeachment. And in fact, the charges they hit him with were just a fraction. I mean, they didn't even do the Mueller report. I mean, this guy is so deeply, deeply corrupt. He was able to stop, supposed to be a check and balance system with Congress having oversight, having ability to check on the executive branch. And didn't happen because of McConnell and how Trump twisted the arms of lawmakers, and the other branch that is supposed to be a part of the check and balances of the United States, created by the framers of the Constitution, the judiciary. I mean, look what Trump is doing to the judiciary. In fact, one of the names on that list of the foxes guarding the hen house when I did the poison conspiracy book when Reagan was elected was now Supreme Court Justice Gorsuch's mother who headed the EPA. It's a horrid situation, and coming to the plate has been, I mean, there's supposed to be these three branches checking and balancing on each other, but the framers also envisioned a press, a free press challenging the whole kit and caboodle. And the free press has, I mean, not the Fox News Channel hasn't, that's become, and this is, speaking of scandal, an enormous journalistic scandal. It's become Trump TV. Nixon didn't even have that. Trump has an extension of himself in mass media with Murdoch's Trump TV. On the other hand, CNN and Wolf Blitzer and MSNBC and Rachel Maddow, I'm just naming a few of the journalists who have Mataibbi have stood up and have done the work that good journalists, particularly investigative journalists, are called to do, telling people a good definition of investigative reporting. A reporter from Ohio, actually, Paul Williams, he wrote the classic book on investigative reporting and editing. And what the late Paul Williams said, he was a founder of Investigative Reporters and Editors, an important group. He said, in defining investigative reporting, it could best be said to be telling people how things really work, not how government officials want to claim things work or corporate executives. but how things really work. And journalists on the level of the internet, I mean, I write a lot for Counterpunch, an excellent internet site. I'd suggest people go to it. Counterpunch is Jeff St. Clair runs Counterpunch, wonderful site. Common Dreams I write for, Nation of Change, excellent work being done on this new medium of the internet. In terms of the print press, the Times, which was always the New York Times described as that gray lady, you know, the a newspaper for the criticism of the Times through the years of the establishment, ain't been the newspaper of the certainly the Trump establishment or any establishment under its editorship now. It's right in front there, challenging the Trump horror. The Washington Post, excellent. I mean, this is a newspaper that really did the job. Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein bringing down Nixon and Watergate, and it's doing all it can to tell people how the Trump administration really works and the damage, the enormous damage it's doing with all these reversals in environmental protection, environmental preservation. Every day is a new outrage. I mean, like right now comes out the news that in the new federal so-called defense budget, billions of dollars to be over $700 billion. They've included a major program to modernize the nuclear weapons arsenal of the United States, to build bigger and better atomic bombs and hydrogen bombs. I've written an awful lot in recent months, and it's been on Counterpunch, and it's been on Nation of Change, been on Common Dreams. Also, I was very happy to see a couple of weeks ago Newsday, which is a major newspaper on Long Island, publishing a piece I wrote about the Space Force, declaring the headline, don't militarize the heavens. So on television, 60 Minutes has been there, and again, let me repeat the name, Rachel Maddow. She's done such a great job with MSNBC. It goes on and on. It's been an important time and a vital time for the press to stand up in the United States, and it has.
Well, I was speaking with Carl Grossman, a professor of journalism, one of the great, great investigative reporters of our generation and of our era. Tell us, you got me on a couple of things here. Let's deal with Rachel Maddow first and MSNBC and CNN.
Right.
They have certainly gone day after day after day attacking Donald Trump. There's no doubt about that. But they've also been extremely, at least many of them, have been extremely against Bernie Sanders. Can you talk about the bias of these two cable networks on Bernie Sanders?
Well, you know, when you get into the vision that Bernie Sanders has of socialism, somehow that crosses a red media line, quite literally. And, you know, I found that, I mean, I was in establishment media, too. The Long Island Press was a part of the Newhouse chain. And I remember I had interviewed George McGovern, who I found to be utterly brilliant. And I sat one-on-one interview with Senator McGovern when he was running against Nixon. And he was so prescient about the expansion of corporate control in this country. Nixon is reelected, and on about the he knew the future, the damage that would be caused, and he talked about the inequity in our system. And then I put a paragraph in the column that I had at the Long Island Press somehow, I forgot exactly my words, but I referred to McGovern's vision being very close to a socialist vision, that a system based on greed, dog-eat-dog, and so forth would be not a good system. The next thing I know, I got a call from my editor, who actually was the editor of the entire Newhouse. He was the national editor of the Newhouse chain. And he said, "Hey, Carl," I mean, he had hired me when I was 22 years old, and here he's calling me up saying, and he let me write all I wanted to through the years in my column until that afternoon. He says, "And call this paragraph you have about socialism and McGovern, you know, sometimes, Carl, you get off the beam." And that's the problem. Unfortunately, in this country, people have not, most people in this country, they should just travel. They should just go to Denmark. They should go to Norway. I mean, I can understand that there's a certain level of, what can I call it, of totalitarianism, frankly, there was in terms of a Soviet style or even Chinese style a communism. But there's other ways that people can organize their societies politically and economically. And if you go to a nation where there is, not socialism, which is not in any way totalitarian-based but or totalitarian-inclined, to provide medical care for people, to assist people fully in education. I mean, think of all the kids. I'm a college professor. The students who have to go into debt, enormous debt, these days in the United States. I mean, that's unheard of all through Europe, where education is provided free or at a very low cost, and so forth. So there's a problem in the U.S. in terms of people understanding fully that socialism can be better than a dog-eat-dog, a greed situation under capitalism. And so then you extend that in terms of media perspective. There are people who manage media who have the same fear. So when Sanders, who's a socialist, he's always been a socialist, and he sticks with his ideal, continues to identify himself as a socialist, he's kind of, as I say, crossed a red media line. And thus, if you're working for MSNBC, you see, in the United States, the way censorship works, and I've taught at SUNY Old Westbury, of course, Politics of Media, it isn't like picking up a paper in Beijing, which I have, and you see the front page. I mean, I don't know what is said in the Chinese language newspapers, but there's English language newspapers, and they talk about the glorious speech made yesterday by the and so forth by this official or that official. In this country, it isn't that the news is twisted in that propagandist way. It's a sin of omission. You just know if you're working for, for many years, the owner of NBC was General Electric. In terms of nuclear, back to nuclear power, the Coke and Pepsi of nuclear power historically are General Electric and Westinghouse. 85% of nuclear power plants worldwide have been of GE and or Westinghouse design or manufacture, and not parenthetically, who owned CBS for many years, but Westinghouse. So if you're working for Westinghouse, if you're working for GE, you kind of know it's that you probably shouldn't write a story about accident hazards of nuclear power or defects in the Indian Point nuclear plant just 30 miles north of Times Square. In New York, and 30 miles north of NBC's in Rockefeller Center, its headquarters. You just got to know, you know. So that's a problem with establishment media. And I didn't mention, and I should have mentioned, thought about it just a few minutes ago when I finished praising, you know, with the Post and the Times and so forth, attacking this Trump mess. The wonderful so-called alternative media outlets we have in this country. I mean, every day when I go to work from Sag Harbor to Old Westbury, it's 75 miles up the road. I'm so fortunate I could tune to 99.5 and listen to a station called WBAI in New York. It's part of the Pacifica chain. Again, establishment media has been doing a good job challenging the Trump administration, but doing the best of jobs, doing the most wonderful job, is this the Pacifica chain and other so-called alternative media. For example, I have a TV show distributed nationally. It's a 200 cable TV systems in the country on the Dish network, DirecTV network, and it's Free Speech TV. It's out of Colorado. It's in fact another Antioch alum is involved with Free Speech TV, Ron Williamson. I mean, great journalism done by Free Speech TV. And there's other outlets. I mean, the great thing about the Internet, there's some not so great things about the Internet these days, the white supremacists using the Internet and so forth. But a great thing about the Internet these days, and I tell this to my students, is, you can make your own media. All you need is a little bit of equipment, and suddenly you have a podcast. All you need is, a high-def camera and a fairly good but not expensive computer, and you can edit your material, and you can go to YouTube, and you can make your own media. So alternative media, and there's, remember back in the 60s, they talked about guerrilla media, and that's with a G-U, you know, not like G-O-R, guerrilla media, but that was small potatoes. Even the underground press, which was great in those days, the alternative media in the 60s and 70s. But today, through, and again, there's two sides of this issue, the Internet. Today, through the Internet, you can get unfiltered expression. You can have your own website, and you can write. You can put video up. You can do audio. And there's a lot of that, too. And that's why a lot of my students, young people, are getting their news from the Internet, from all kind of independent websites. Now, just let me add, I'm very concerned, as has occurred internationally in the last several years, of government. I mean, the notion of Trump being reelected is what a nightmare. And if that occurs, what's happened in other countries around the world, suppression of the Internet. But as of now, as of today, and hopefully if people act and organize and work, we can get this Trump out of office. As of today, the Internet is a free platform of expression.
Well, I got to say, first of all, I never say that Trump might get reelected. He wasn't elected in the first place. And you
right.
have to wonder, given the nature of the Democratic Party, if Tom Perez and these guys aren't really Trump operatives. I mean, they're so unbelievably incompetent and pro-corporate. I will say on socialism, and I do have a book coming out about this, in my history of the U.S., the People's Spiral of U.S. History. You have a continuum here. You know, Bernie Sanders is not really a socialist. And he likes to call himself a socialist. And he admires Eugene V. Debs, and I would never want to pull back or hide from what he thinks he stands for. But traditional socialism has called for the government to own the means of production. What Bernie Sanders, and he has explicitly rejected that. Bernie Sanders, what he really is a New Deal Democrat. And I wish he would start campaigning on the economic bill of rights that that Franklin Roosevelt put out in 1944, and that was accepted as a resolution, joint resolution of Congress, basically saying that everyone, his line was necessitous men, in other words, men in need, and women. He didn't say women at the time, although he had an incredibly powerful wife. Necessitous men are not free men. If you need food, clothing, housing, education, medical care, transportation, you're in need, and you're not free, and it's not a democracy. So Franklin Roosevelt, like Bernie Sanders, they're really social democrats, is what they are. And Trump, of course, is a capitalist, and there is a continuum. A totalitarian capitalist is a fascist. There are capitalists who believe in democracy. I know it's hard to imagine, but they do. And so you have capitalism, and on the far right, you have fascism, which is what Trump is, a totalitarian capitalist. On the left, you have socialism and democratic socialism. And then totalitarian socialism turns out to be communism because of the line in Marx's Communist Manifesto and his other work where he talks about a dictatorship of the proletariat. And, my feeling is that totalitarian communism has more in common with totalitarian capitalism, which is fascism, than it does with democratic socialism, which is what Bernie Sanders is. I mean, he is certainly no, and the history of the Socialist Party in the United States, dating Eugene V. Debs, has had a much stronger commitment to the Bill of Rights, to freedom of speech, press, assembly, and all that, than either the Democratic or the Republican Party. Go ahead, Carl.
Well, I agree with you totally, Harvey, and as I wrote for a blurb about your new book, it is utterly brilliant. I mean, and so clear, and everything is put forward in such a incisive and great way. Thinking about, the difference between, I think about the campaign for governor of California by a full socialist who was also a great journalist, Upton Sinclair. And Upton Sinclair, he ran for governor of California in 1934 on End Poverty in California. That was the name of the movement. And who undermined his campaign? Upton Sinclair's campaign, the Democratic Party of the day. I mean, I've been writing a lot, as I note, in recent months on this Space Force, which, there's so many disasters in the making that have been created already of the Trump administration. But this Space Force is really something that, I mean, what Trump is doing is opening space to war. He's bringing war. I mean, it's been bad enough, that we've had forever war on the surface of this planet. But what Trump is doing in creating a U.S. space force is just asking Russia and China to meet us in kind. And, I mean, they've not wanted to go up into space with weaponry. And I know this from speaking to them, and I know them, diplomats from both countries, and I know it from the record. I mean, there's the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, which the United States, the Soviet Union, and the United Kingdom, those three nations put together. My writings on this, I did a book, Weapons in Space, and my TV programs on this, I quote Craig Eisenroth, still around. He was a young attorney in the U.S. State Department in the 60s, and he explains that we wanted to de-weaponize space before it got weaponized. And the Outer Space Treaty has been ratified, it's been signed on to by virtually every country on Earth. And Canada, our neighbor Canada, and Russia and China have been trying for decades to expand the Outer Space Treaty, not just as it is today and has been since 67, banning weapons of mass destruction and nuclear weapons in space. Canada, China, and Russia have been leaders in an effort to ban all weapons in space, all weapons in space. And which country has stopped this? I mean, I've been at the UN to watch the vote. One country after another votes for, it's called the Paros Treaty, Prevention of an Arms Race in Outer Space Treaty. What country stops the U.S. ambassador, raises his or her hand and says no, and essentially vetoes the Paros Treaty at the U.N.? But if the U.S. does what Trump is talking about, Trump has now said over and over again, it's not enough for the U.S. to have a presence in space. We have to dominate space. I mean, Russia and China are just not going to stand for that, even though they've wanted to abide by, to adhere by, in fact, to expand the notion of the Outer Space Treaty to keep space for peace. They're going to be up there, and they're going to meet us in kind. There'll be other nations up there, too. And in the end, Trump will have extended war to the heavens, to space, and there'll be no turning back. Now, the vote for U.S. Space Force, this is just this past December, in the House of Representatives, was like 189 Republicans voted for it, and 188 Democrats voted for it. In the Senate, the margin was even bigger in terms of the Democrats who voted for it. I mean, it was just shameful what the Democrats did, and why they did it is a trip. In fact, the New York Times, which hasn't been great, I've been praising the media, but in terms of space and nuclear issues, ain't going to praise the media. They've always been, U.S. Space stuff being kind of a patriotic happening. Walter Cronkite was the model of being a booster for space stuff. Space reporters at the Cape would say at press conferences, actually say, you can look at transcripts of press conferences, when are we going to launch? And as you know, Harvey, in terms of the media, the establishment media and nuclear, I mean, that's why I call my first book on nuclear power, Cover Up What You're Not Supposed to Know About Nuclear Power. And it's hundreds of pages of stuff that you're not going to learn about through the New York Times or the Washington Post. So this was terrible, terrible. Well, the deal that was made with the Democrats, and the Times reported this, was that Kushner, Jared Kushner, the Trump advisor and son-in-law, arranged a deal with the Democrats to extend parental leave for government employees, something which is common all over the world, and in exchange, they voted for the National Defense Authorization Act, which provides for establishment of a space force. I mean, what a trade-off! Doing this parental leave thing, which again is normal all over. We should have had it years ago, decades ago. It's nothing so special. It's just something automatically with it. We should provide for government employees. We made a trade-off of historical proportions, turning space into an arena of war. And here were the Democrats, with some exceptions. There were some exceptions. Congressman Jerry Nadler, for example, congressperson, and some others. But generally speaking, the Democrats took a dive. And so, and I've been very critical about this stuff, as I was during the Obama administration. of Barack Obama when he ran for office, knowing about nuclear power. I mean, he wasn't a dummy like George W. Bush. There's this very famous meeting he had up in New Hampshire where he tells the editorial board of a New Hampshire newspaper, these nuclear plants, they can blow up, people can get killed, and there's alternatives, there's solar and wind. And then he becomes the president of the United States and takes an enormous dive, and then he's talking about clean nuclear energy and so forth. And I wrote many a story for particularly Counterpunch on that one. Counterpunch was just so terrific on the Obama nuclear policy, the Obama nuclear program. There is a big difference. But I think what we have to focus on more than anything else now today, Harvey, is getting Trump out. I mean, Trump represents the old book was "It Can't Happen Here." It's happening here, and if he is reelected, whether it's issues of freedom of the press or whether it's issues of nuclear technology or nuclear war, I mean, in the new defense, this is just a few weeks old that he's introduced. Again, he's talking about bigger and better nuclear weaponry and the Space Force. And what I see with the Space Force in terms of nukes and weapons, I did a documentary, people can view it, called Nukes in Space, the Nuclearization and Weaponization of the Heavens. Star Wars, Reagan's Star Wars, was predicated on orbiting battle platforms with hypervelocity beam weapons and laser weapons and particle beam weapons, and the energy for these high energy weapons would be on reactors and super plutonium systems on orbiting battle platforms. In fact, General James Abramson, who was the commander of the so-called Strategic Defense Initiative, Star Wars, he says at one point, unless we have reactors in orbit, we're going to need a long extension cord going down to Earth, bringing up power. So visualize the future with a Trump reelection, with a Space Force. And right now, incidentally, U.S. Air Force bases are in the process of changing their names to U.S. Space Force bases. I mean, we are just asking Russia and China to get up there. We're going to have a big fight, and obviously, the aerospace corporations just love this because they stand to make billions and tens of billions. Star Wars was, and now with Trump, Star Wars could be one of the biggest, if not the biggest, it's been described actually in the trade press as one of the biggest construction projects, development projects in history. So the main thing has to be, Harvey, not that we have a great alternative in many respects. We got to get Trump out. We just have to get Trump out and then build, rebuild a democratic American society and put a lid on this rise of fascism in the United States.
Yeah, well, Carl Grossman, one thing, I do hope you'll review my book for Counterpunch. It would make a huge difference. I appreciate your
pleasure.
Blur, but an actual review would really be a big plus. We're talking with Carl Grossman, professor of history, one of the great lifelong campaigners against the nuclear madness and this exposition of Trump's insanity in outer space. I mean, obviously, it has nothing to do with national security. He probably wants to put a Trump hotel on the moon. It's all about it's all about personal profit and personal power with Donald Trump. At least we're spared the idiotic ideological garbage that we had to suffer through during the Cold War. I mean, Trump is just a flat-out mobster. It's all about money. and power with him, not that he'd be able to articulate any of the great ideological debates that we had in the 60s, 50s, and all that stuff. But, Carl, your reporting at the bottom of it has really made a huge difference. We are here in California trying to deal with Diablo Canyon nuclear plant, which we can't even get our so-called liberal governor to inspect. They're talking about taking over the utility company, but they never discuss the company's number one or parent number one asset. We don't really know how much it's worth, the two reactors at Diablo Canyon. They are the biggest heat emitters in the state. And you, of course, are facing in New York the bailout from this idiot Andrew Cuomo of four atomic reactors in upstate New York. He has been talking about shutting the two at Indian Point, the two reactors 35 miles north of Manhattan. Give us an update on that. Is that actually happening? What's the story with Indian Point?
Well, it's in motion. But there is a kind of escape clause in the deal that Andrew Cuomo has put together to close these two, Indian Point 2 and 3. Indian Point 1 was closed years ago because it didn't have even emergency core cooling system, didn't have the most rudimentary, safety mechanism. But at the same time, Harvey, it's important for people to know that under the guise of clean energy, what Andrew Cuomo has done was to bail out four upstate nuclear power plants, which, in fact, the utilities involved, because they're not economic, wanted to just say forget about. But because in some of these upstate communities, in New York State, I mean, they provide some level of jobs. Considering how they can devastate those communities with an accident, you're talking about old nuclear plants, and now the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission is proceeding to relicense nuclear plants to 80 years. 80 years. I mean, nuclear plants were never seen as operating for beyond 40 years, that the metals would become so embrittled and so forth. And now, 80 years, so these nukes upstate would go for 80 years, and even can talk 100 years. Relicensing and extending the licenses, operating licenses.
Carl, we got to stop, unfortunately. Carl Grosser, you've been magnificent, as always. How do people get a hold of you?
Just go to my website, carlgrossman.com. Love to hear from people.
Okay, Carl, thank you so much. Thanks for talking. Send you the PDF for the book, a link to the show, and we'll be back next week. And so are Toby. You've been a great, great, great guest. Talk to you soon.
And the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn.